Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Bishop Howard J. Hubbard. Bishop Hubbard is the spiritual leader of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Albany. In that role, he's responsible for 125 parishes that serve an estimate of more than 360,000 Catholics residing in the 14 counties of the diocese. Bishop Hubbard is the longest tenured bishop of a single diocese in the nation. And on October 31st, when he turned 75, something that is hard for me to imagine having known him for quite a while, the mandatory retirement age for a bishop, he must submit his formal resignation to the Holy See in Rome. It could be a few months or a year or more until the Vatican chooses his successor and the 10th Bishop of Albany is named. Bishop Hubbard has earned a reputation as a compassionate leader and articulate spokesman, especially for the most vulnerable and needy in our society. As a result, Bishop Hubbard chairs and serves on numerous national committees, including his service as chairman of the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, a committee of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. A Troy native, he attended St. Patrick's Elementary School and LaSalle Institute and was ordained as a priest on December 18, 1963, at the Church of St. Ignatius in Rome. Bishop Hubbard began his priestly service in 1964 as associate pastor at St. Joseph's Parish, Schenectady, and at the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception, Albany, in 1966, and at the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception, Albany. In 1966, at Bishop Edward McGinn's request, he established Providence House, a referral and crisis intervention center in Albany's South End, and in 1967, he founded Hope House, an Albany-based residential treatment center for adults and adolescents that provides education, intervention, and treatment to those whose lives have been affected by chemical dependency. On March 27, 1977, at age 38, Howard J. Hubbard became the youngest bishop in the country. His tenure as bishop has been marked by the goals he outlined in two pastoral letters: collaboration, collegiality, and shared responsibility. There will be a special mass at the Immaculate Conception Cathedral, 3 p.m. this Sunday. Howard Hubbard, it's such a joy to see you here. You have always been one of my favorite people in and around Albany. You're a man, I think, not only of great wisdom, but incredible courage. It's so good to have you with us.
Alan, it's great to be with you, and the admiration that you so graciously extended to me is reciprocal, believe me.
That is so nice to hear. Well, why did you get into it in the first place? How did it happen?
That I became a priest?
Yes.
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, I attended St. Patrick's Elementary School in Troy, and I had the Sisters of St. Joseph's there, and in those days we had four priests in our parish. And early on, I was asked to serve on the altar, and I got to know the priests through that service, and I found them to be very kind, warm persons with whom I could easily relate. And I was impressed by the way in which they were involved in the lives of the families of the parish, doing their baptisms, their weddings, attending wakes and funerals, and taking a great interest in the young of the parish, involving them in sports and other social activities. And I was really very much impressed by how much their lives were touching the people at the grassroots level. And I think that's what inspired me to think about the priesthood for myself.
Did you have to give up anything consciously when you knew that? I mean, after all, there's all the social stuff, there's the dating, there's, you know, women, there's all that. Was it a balancing act?
I'll be honest with you, it really wasn't. You know, I grew up in the so-called placid 50s. It was before the counter-revolution, if you will, before the sexual revolution. And I don't think there was the premium that's presently placed upon sexual intimacy. And certainly I would have liked to have had a family of my own. But the idea of living a celibate life wasn't really overwhelming for me at that point in time. Obviously, being a human being, there are times when you would like to have a one-to-one relationship with another person. But when you've made a commitment to God, you try to be faithful to that commitment.
Let's go directly to Pope Francis. You know, it is a most interesting thing. We've lived through conservative popes. We now have somebody who is quite remarkable in his fresh approach, I think, to the church. I wonder if you talk about what he means to you.
Well, he has certainly been a ray of light in the past 6 months, since he's been the successor of Peter and the Pope in the Church, he has surprised and delighted many, both with his tone and with his style. I think he's rather centrist in terms of his theology. I don't anticipate we're going to see any major changes in the Church, like married priests and woman priests, things like that. But it's his whole demeanor, his simplicity, his humility, his obvious love for people that I think is impacting upon not only people within the Roman Catholic Church, but people in general who learned of him. When he was the Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires, he didn't live in an Episcopal residence like most bishops do. He took a small apartment where he did his own cooking. He didn't have a driver or a car. He took public transportation. And since moving to Rome, he decided not to live in the Apostolic Palace. He's living in the Dome of Santa Marta, which is a little hotel with inside the Vatican walls. And there he takes his meals with who's ever a guest there at the hotel. He says Mass for the guests every day. He traded in his Mercedes-Benz for a Ford. And then recently, somebody gave him a little Renault with 197,000 miles on it, which he uses to travel around the back ends of the Vatican City State. So he is just a very down-to-earth, simple person. He's called for a reform of the Curia. He's called for an end of what he calls clerical careerism.
Well, I'm sorry, can we just stop there and ask you about both of those? What are they?
Well, clerical careerism is where you are in the clergy for your own advancement to higher positions in the Church. And he said, you know, we need people who want to serve the people. Obviously, there are offices like bishops and archbishops and cardinals in the Church, but he doesn't want people to be lining themselves in a position to move up the ladder. If you're chosen for that, fine, but not because you're manipulating for it. As far as the reform of the Curia, he has asked 8 cardinals to come up with recommendations for the reform of the Curia. Right now, the governance of the Church is very centralized in the Vatican, and he has indicated that he would like to see more authority being given to local bishops' conferences and to local bishops. He's trying to say that bishops are not just branch managers from central administration. Rather, bishops have the fullness of the episcopacy in their own diocese and should have much more flexibility in overseeing the life of the Church within the parameters of the universal law of the Church, of course.
Is he a good politician in that he picked the right people to sit on the Reform Commission?
Well, he's chosen people from all over the world. He didn't do it necessarily by continent, but in an interview he gave, he said, I didn't pick the most powerful people. I picked the people I thought were best in terms of how they govern their own diocese and how I'd like to see the Church governed.
You know, when you were talking about the humility of the man, you reminded me of somebody, you. Extraordinary. I mean, you know, you didn't start following him. You've been driving an old car with 197,000 miles or more, getting around to your vast group of churches in our region. You've been living simply. You've been living in a very modified position compared to some of the other people in, you know, in religion and in the Church. What led you to that?
Well, I was very fortunate in my early priesthood. My first full-time assignment was at the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception.
That's the big cathedral here in Albany.
That's the big cathedral right next to the Governor's Mansion in Albany. And I was assigned there as an associate pastor and also worked in the grammar school. And in that capacity, I had the opportunity to visit all the families. And in those days, it was in the middle of the erection of the South Mall. And so many of the neighborhoods had been totally depleted. And people were discouraged and were uncertain about their future. And some of those who were left behind were very poor. And I had the opportunity to work with the poor and to learn from them. And I believe it was that experience, coupled with my later experience at Providence House and at Hope House, that gave me an understanding of the priesthood as being one of service, not of one of a priest sitting in a rectory waiting for people to come to him, but one where and you must reach out to the people, identify with them, learn from their needs and wants and hopes and desires, and then try to be responsive as best you can. And I think that that experience of living among those who were poor and underprivileged underscored for me that, like the founder of our church, Jesus, who had no home in which to lay his head, that's the type of life that we as priests should live.
Very rare. I mean, you know, there was a major residence that you gave up in order to live much more simply. And so I guess I want to ask you this question. How many Howard Hubbards are there in the church?
Well, I think there are more than you hear about. So often we hear stories when there's a scandal or when somebody is living an obviously opulent lifestyle that would call attention to them. But most of our priests live very simple lives. We make salaries of between $25,000 and $35,000.
Yeah, the bishop makes the same salary that the priests do, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, a bishop is entitled to take a bigger salary if he wishes, but I've always taken the same salary that the other priests of my years of seniority receive.
Does that, do you think, create a sort of morale within the church, within the people who work with you, that, you know, this leader doesn't take more than we take?
I don't think so. I believe that they feel that maybe that allows me to identify more with them, that I have the same resources in terms of my own personal lifestyle as they do.
You're sort of known within the church, as we indicated at the beginning of this, as a leader, the Bishops' Conference in the United States. Sometimes people tend to try to set up categories, conservatives and liberals, and you're always tagged as a liberal, are you?
I don't really think I am. I think I'm more of a moderate. I think the church has become more conservative over the past 30 years. And so by contrast, that makes me look more of a liberal. But if I were to self-identify myself, I would consider myself a moderate person.
So what are the issues that divide the church right now?
Well, I think a major issue is what I referred to in terms of the reform of the Roman Curia. That is, giving more opportunity for what we call collegiality in the church, which would mean that it's not just the clergy or the clergy and religious that have all of the authority and power in the church, but the church is God's people. And every member of the church, by virtue of his or her baptism and confirmation, is called to holiness and ministry. And at all levels in the church, we should be involving the laity in decision-making, be it at the parish council level, be it at the diocesan level with our priest council and our diocesan pastoral council, or be it at the national level with our national advisory council. More and more, I think, we have to be attuned to the needs and concerns of the people of God, and we have to have structures and mechanisms whereby their voice can be heard.
That's just fascinating, and you probably know more about my religion than I do, about Judaism than I do, but it seems to me that one of the differences between the way the Catholics do it and the Jews do it is that, theoretically anyway, Jews have no interceding person between them and their God, whereas the church says, okay, these are the people, these professionals who know the stuff and who really are, you know, really should be able to counsel you and tell you what to do. Does that make any sense?
Well, I understand that we have a structure between a direct relationship between God and oneself. Now, obviously, any person can and really should have a direct relationship with God. Our call as followers of Jesus is to come to know him, to understand his values and ideals, and to try to implement them in one's life. And that should be done through prayer, which is a personal direct communication between God and the individual. However, how the church itself is organized varies from one denomination to another. And we have a hierarchical church, and it's the leaders of the church that kind of set the rules and policies. And through collegiality, which is an old concept that has been lost through the course of the church's history but recovered at the Second Vatican Council, we are trying to give more of an opportunity for the lay people to have greater input into the laws and the policies that we develop within our community.
Now, there are several, as you just indicated, groups that have very important roles in the church. You have Franciscans, you have Jesuits. Many of us don't really know what some of those differences are. Could you tell us?
Well, The groups you mentioned are what we call religious communities. These are men, and in case of women, religious communities, women who take a vow of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And they usually have a particular focus for their apostolate. For example, the Jesuits are very much involved in education. And the Franciscans historically have been involved in working for the poor, although they also run schools and parishes.
Pope is Franciscan.
The Pope himself is a Jesuit.
A Jesuit.
He's the first Jesuit ever to be elected the Pope. Now there's a joke.
Why is that?
Well, there's a joke in the church that a woman says she has two sons that are priests and one that's a Jesuit. It's always...
certain amount of prejudice.
Well, the Jesuits have always been considered cutting edge, and they've been under suspicion. As a matter of fact, they've been banned in certain countries.
As proselytizers or...
Proselytizers, but also more because of their policies.
They might be dangerous.
On the cutting edge.
Yeah.
And that's just a joke.
I got it.
They're good and wonderful priests and brothers and ministers, but...
What are you?
I'm a diocesan priest. That means I'm ordained for a given geographical area. Now, religious order priests usually transcend many dioceses. For example, we have the Jesuit community for New York and New England, or for the Midwest, or for the West. But when you're a diocesan priest, your immediate superior is your diocesan bishop, and your assignments, unless you get an exemption, take place within the geographic region of your diocese, which in our case is 14 counties. Whereas the Jesuits could be assigned throughout their province and even be assigned to do work internationally.
But do they ever become diocesan priests, Jesuits?
Ordinarily, they do not become diocesan priests, but some have been named bishops, like the present Pope was the superior general of his Jesuit community in Argentina.
The head guy.
He was their superior. He was their bishop, so to speak, for the Jesuits. But then he became a diocesan bishop, but he still retained his Jesuit roots and his relationship with the Jesuit community. And even now, even though he's a Holy Father and has responsibility for the oversight of the entire church, he still is a Jesuit priest.
Now, I read recently in a newspaper article that some of the conservatives in the church are angry at him because he's reached out to gay people and others and saying that everybody, has a soul and everybody deserves to be well treated. I don't want to misstate it, but that the conservative element in the church are angry at him. I'd always thought of the church, Curia and others, the people who picked the popes, as conservative themselves, and the last couple of guys have been conservative. So I'm wondering how it happened. Did they know what they were getting?
Well, it's interesting. I only know this from what I've read in the newspaper.
Sure.
I don't know from firsthand accounts. But it was unusual to have the retirement of a pope. Pope Benedict is the first pope in 600 years who retired. So ordinarily after a pope died, which was how the succession would take place, the cardinals would come for the funeral, and then almost immediately after the funeral, the conclave would be called because you didn't want to send them all the way back to their homes, and they had to come back for a conclave to elect the pope. But this time, with the pope retiring, they had much more time between the announcement of retirement and when the conclave was called. And so they had a number of what they called pre-clunk meetings in which they discussed what they were looking for in a new pope. And it's my understanding that at one of those conclave meetings, Cardinal Bergoglio, as he was at the time, talked about the need for reform in the Curia and the need to give more autonomy to local bishops' conference and to local diocesan bishops. And apparently that resonated with the minds and hearts of the cardinal electors. And from what I understand, put them kind of in the limelight when they came to voting.
Well, that's fascinating. So even if you were a conservative cardinal and, you were getting orders from the top and all of a sudden somebody came along and said, hey, we ought to devolve more authority on the cardinal, it didn't matter whether you were conservative or a liberal, you liked it. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. I think they liked his tone, his style, and what he had to say. And something I didn't know at the time, but I found out subsequently, when Pope Benedict XVI was elected, Cardinal Bergoglio was second in the voting. But when they were kind of trying to figure out who the new pope was going to be, his name was not mentioned. And I believe the reason his name was not mentioned is that he is 76 years old.
Mm.
And after the long pontificate of Pope John Paul II and his growing debility in the end of his pontificate, and with the retirement of Benedict XVI, having been elected at the age of 78 and retiring at 85, I think there was a thought that the College of Cardinals would be looking for a younger man. Now, by a younger man, I mean somebody between the age of 65 and 70. So that's where the prognosticators were focusing in terms of who might be, as they call, papabile. So I think in one sense...
I'm sorry, what's papabile?
It means a candidate for the Pope,
Okay.
One who's likely to be elected Pope. So I think in that sense, people were expecting someone a little younger than the present Pope.
I should point out to everybody that you're listening to Bishop Howard Hubbard, one of my favorite people in the world, and I wanted to ask you, Bishop, whether or not sometimes raw politics plays a role in these elections. I mean, for example, well, let's get an old guy because he won't last that long and I'll have a better chance the next time.
Well, I'm not going to say that politics doesn't take place. I'm sure that it doesn't. And we have, certainly during the Middle Ages, when the Pope was a sovereign power over the papal states, as well as the head of the church, there was a lot of politics involved. And even today, in any dynamic, depending upon how you define politics, there is maneuvering to kind of get your candidate. Now, it was interesting that what you suggested relative to electing an older pope, and he'll soon pass on and I'll have a better chance later on, they said that when Pius XII died in 1958 after 20-year pontificate, they were looking for a short-termer. And so he elected Pope John XXIII, who I think was 77 at the time. And they thought he would be a short-term pope, kind of keep the throne warm until they figured out who they wanted for the long run. Well, it turned out he became one of the most revolutionary popes in history.
Indeed.
Because he called the Second Vatican Council, and even though he died before the council was completed, I think that the Second Vatican Council has probably been the greatest historical event in the life of the church in the past 500 years.
So you never know what you're going to get.
You never know what you're going to get. And that's how I think we have to understand that our God is a God of surprises, and that ultimately it's God that's in charge and not our own carefully calculated programs, plans, and patterns.
Wow. What do you think Pope Benedict is thinking as he sits there? Do you think this consultation between him and Pope Francis?
I doubt if there's much consultation. Pope Benedict is a very gentle and humble man. I know that he's got the reputation of being kind of a watchdog because that was his responsibility when he was head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, to oversee the authenticity of faith, and if there was someone that was going off the ranch, so to speak, it was his responsibility to call them back. When you look at his encyclicals, while they're done in a very scholarly fashion, they're extremely well done and very insightful, and I think will have a long shelf life. But when Benedict retired, he said that he intended to in no way interfere with his successor, and I think that's true. You know, when we went to Rome every 5 years, as we have to do as bishops, to make a report of our diocese, in addition to meeting with the Pope, we would meet with the heads of the various congregations or councils that support the Pope. And the one you never wanted to miss was the meeting with Cardinal Ratzinger, because unlike so many of the others who had a kind of prepared agenda of what they wanted you to know from them, he was open-ended. He was gracious.
This is Benedict.
Yes, yes. He was gracious. He was gentle. And he invited, what do we think about issues? What were the front burner issues for us? And how do we think the church should handle
them? But did anybody ever think, he's trying to trick me to say something?
I don't think so, because he came across so down to earth and so genuine. I think the image that he had is God's Rottweiler, was not true when you interacted with him on a one-to-one basis.
Well, Bishop Hubbard, you've had, not the easiest time. The church has diminished in terms of the numbers, the priests. There's always, obviously, the sexual scandals within the church. Did you find that you were being tested, in some way by God during all of this?
Well, I certainly didn't anticipate what I was going to face.
Right.
The church today in 2013 is far different than it was in 1977. And as you pointed out, we've had a decline in the numbers of clergy and religious. When I was ordained a priest in 1963, there were 400 active diocesan priests in Albany. When I became bishop in 1977, there were 300, and today we're just around the 100 mark.
Wow.
And that has forced me to figure out how best to realign our limited personnel resources in a way that we can continue the life of the church and the sacraments and liturgy on an ongoing basis. And that has meant the closure, merger, and consolidation of a number of parishes. And I know how heartbreaking that is for people, because the church is a person's spiritual home. And it's like being forcibly removed from your own home. And I had to close my home parish, my home school, which was heartbreaking. That's where I grew up. That's where my roots are. That's
in Troy.
In Troy. That's where I first came to know God and to know the traditions of our faith community and participate in the sacraments. And so to close a church or to close a school is very heartbreaking for all involved. And that has been a tough test.
And when people get angry at you for doing that, do you get, like I do, defensive, or do you sort of just have an understanding of what it is?
Well, I think earlier on in my priesthood and episcopacy, I got more defensive. But I think over the years, I realized that I should not take it personally, that I'm trying to do the best I can with the lights and the information and counsel I have available to me, and I have to understand their hurt and pain, and I want to be empathetic toward it, but I don't have to necessarily appropriate to myself. The other, of course, major crisis has been the crisis of clergy sexual abuse, which is both a sin and a crime, and it has done irreparable harm to our church, and we're doing everything we can to assure that this never reoccur. I think it's important to point out that most of the abuse took place between 1965 and 1985, but most of the reporting of the abuse has taken place between 1995 and the present. And there are a variety of reasons for this. I think there was a fear of reporting the priest, and the fear that, well, nobody's going to believe a priest would do this, and they'll blame me. And sometimes the priest would intimidate the victim not to tell anybody and so forth. And I'll be honest with you, I can say that I've always taken every complaint or allegation seriously. And I've investigated thoroughly, and I've tried to do the right thing. But I would have to admit that at the beginning, while I knew it was morally wrong and sinful, I didn't appreciate the long-term consequence that it would have upon the individual if there was not therapeutic intervention. You know, I thought it was, for want of an analogy, like a broken leg, which was harmful and hurtful at the time, but that would heal and the person could go on. And I only learned over a period of time that without intervention, this could have lifelong psychological consequences. And I also had to admit that there was a scandal involved, and we weren't desirous of putting out our dirty laundry on the line, and I didn't always have the transparency that should have been there and now is expected. And so I certainly made mistakes in dealing with it, but I can also say that, number one, I never tried to intimidate a victim. I never tried to in any way discourage a victim from reporting the matter to law authorities. In fact, the initial complaints I got usually came from law enforcement who wanted me to do something about the issue. And then when parents came, often they didn't want law enforcement involved. They didn't want their son or daughter to be dragged through that. They wanted two things. They wanted an apology, and they wanted to be ensured that no one else would ever be subject to that type of behavior on the part of a priest. But after the mid-1990s, especially when this became more well-known and sexual lawsuits were followed and high fines or penalties were sanctioned, it became much more about money. And I don't deny that that money isn't due to a person, but that became a much more prominent element in dealing with the whole situation than it was in the earlier stage of my priesthood.
How does that work in terms of a diocese? If you have a priest who's done wrong and you get sued, does the money come out of the individual diocese or does it come out of the Catholic Church as a whole?
It comes from the individual diocese. Dioceses are insured. Some dioceses are self-insured. Some are insured by insurance holders. And we use that insurance to make reparation for the harm that was done.
There are those who say that there should be, that in the beginning of the church, priests were allowed to marry, and that it's unnatural. You've addressed this in terms of your own case, but that it's unnatural and that we would be better off. We have a crisis in terms of how many priests there are and everything else, not to go back to that.
Well, I think that's something that has to be given serious consideration. For the first 1,000 years of the church's history, there were married priests. Mm-hmm. The apostles were married, all except one. And up to the year 1,000, 1,200, there were married priests. And then for a variety of reasons, it was determined that priests had to live a celibate life. But we have married priests in the church today. We have priests of the Eastern Rite in the church who were allowed to continue their practice of having married clergy. So we have married priests right here within our diocese in the Eastern churches. And also more recently...
Now the Eastern churches, though, just for clarification, are they part of the...
They're part of the Roman Catholic community.
Gotcha.
Now, some of the Eastern churches, Eastern Orthodox are not, but the Eastern Catholics are. And they continue their traditions, and one of those traditions is married clergy.
What is your observation about how that's been working?
Well, I think for them it's been working well. Mm-hmm. And then we're now allowing priests who were married in a Protestant denomination convert to the church. They are able to function as a married priest in the church. So we do have examples presently of married priests in the church, and I think they're well accepted. And if the polls are accurate, as I believe they usually are, it indicates that most Catholics would be willing to be served by married priests. And so I think it's something that has to be very seriously considered by the church.
So when you retire, or when you send your required resignation as you become 75 years old, which is hard for me to believe, as I said before, are there examples of bishops who have been asked to stay on for considerable amounts of time?
Yes, there have been, usually the cardinals, because the cardinals can remain as electors of the pope until they're 80. So they had to submit their resignation like every other bishop at the age of 75.
Right.
But the pope was more inclined to allow them to stay on to 80 because they're still going to be electors of the pope. Ordinarily, what you do is on your birthday, you submit your resignation to the Pope. Now, my birthday is October 31st, Halloween. I was born on October 31st, 1938, and I'm proud of the fact that that was the night of the War of the Worlds by Orson Welles. And so I was kind of born under scary circumstances, I guess. But that letter goes to the Apostolic Nuncio in Washington, and he submits it to the Vatican. Then within a few weeks, you get a response back. It can be, we accept the resignation right now. It can be, as more ordinary, we accept the resignation now, but to be effective when your successor is appointed. And that can be anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months to 2 years. You just don't know. So I'm in a state of suspended animation once I submit that letter until my successor is appointed.
So who makes the decision? You say it goes to Rome, but does the cardinal here in New York have anything to say about it?
Yes. All of the bishops in New York State have an opportunity to comment both on the state of the diocese, its spiritual condition, or its financial condition, as the case may be, and also they can suggest potential candidates for that diocese. There's also a consultation that is done selectively among priests, deacons, and laity, and all of that is submitted to the Apostolic Nuncio in Washington. And then he packages that and forwards it to the Congregation for Bishops in Rome. And then they have that input plus input from other parts of the country. And I should note that the officers of the Bishop's Conference, the president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer also have an opportunity to comment. And then the Congregation for Bishops, which is composed of about 20 cardinals, they then review all of this material, and they develop what they call a terna, a name, a list of three names to be submitted to the Pope in rank order, 1, 2, and 3. The Pope can accept the first one or reject the first one or two and take the third, or he can say, I don't like the terna at all. This is more what I'm interested in, and send it back. So it is ultimately the Pope who makes the decision, but after all of that input.
Tell me about the bishops' conference. I mean, obviously, when the bishops get together in a country or a state, you can have a more liberal or conservative approach towards organization. You've played a big part in the bishops' groups. How's that? Can you give us an insight into what goes on?
Well, I would say that the conference is far different today than it was when I entered in 1977. I think that in 1977, the vision and the spirit of the Second Vatican Council were very much alive among the bishops.
Which was, just for our listeners, a sort of progressive liberal orientation towards things.
Well, it was obviously in light of the changes that had been made by the Second Vatican Council. I think that Pope John Paul II felt that some of the changes had gone too far. And I think that you can see in his episcopal appointments that he was looking for a more traditional approach to overseeing the life of the church. And he was a pope for a long time, from 1978 to 2005. And so he had a big influence on shaping the complexion of the bishops' conference. And I think it moved more to the center or center-right than it was when I first became bishop.
And did that affect the councils of bishops that you served, have served in?
Yes, I would think that the agenda was more on internal church issues than external church issues. For example, during the 1980s, the Bishops of the United States issued some very influential letters on war and peace, on the economy, on immigration, where I think more recently our attention has been focused more on internal church issues, like marriage, like abortion, like catechetical teaching. So I do think there has been a marked shift in that direction.
So when the bishops come up with something that might not be acceptable to the Vatican, you know, a difference of opinion, what happens?
Well, obviously the Vatican has the ultimate word. If it's going to be a teaching document,
yes.
If it is not a unanimous vote by the bishops, then it has to go to the Vatican for approval.
Oh, interesting.
And a unanimous vote for the bishops is almost impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, right now we vote by computer. So I might intend to press yes, and by mistake hit no.
Yeah.
And that could be the one vote
that
would be the end of it. So in a certain sense, everything does have to go to the Vatican if it's a teaching document. So I think that's one of the things that Pope Francis is going to ask the cardinals and bishops to look at.
Ah. When Mario Cuomo was the governor, when he would do something that was deemed unacceptable by some members of the clergy, I guess this is a bad thing to say to a bishop, there would be hell to pay. And somebody would say, you know, I'm a member of the New York Post, one of the bishops saying that he would burn in hell forever. You know, I'm wondering whether it's the job of the clergy to keep Catholic politicians in line.
I don't think it's the job of the clergy to keep Catholic politicians in line. I think it's the job of the Catholic politicians to form their conscience in accord with what they believe to be good, sound, moral, and ethical principles. And I think that we have to allow the politicians to use their good conscience. On the other hand, I think that we as a church have to continue to teach as we understand the teaching of the church to be as handed down to us through the centuries. But I don't think it's the job of the bishop to be censuring politicians at any level in the church.
We're talking to Bishop Howard Hubbard. If you were to look back on your career in the church, what would you have done differently?
Well, I already indicated that I think I had a thinner skin earlier on, so I think I would have a tougher skin, and I think that comes with maturity. I was very young when I was ordained a bishop, at least for that responsibility. I was 38 years of age. I think I would do more consultation than I have done. I think that we've done very well in the Diocese of Albany compared to other dioceses in terms of collaborative and collegial bodies, but I think we could do more in that direction. And I think that I would probably get out of the office a little more and do a little more delegating of administration and a little more direct pastoral care than I've done. I've tried to be a pastoral bishop, but with all of the issues that you've already cited, like the closures, merging, consolidation of parishes, with trying to figure out how to allocate our scarce personnel resources, and with the sexual abuse crisis, that has taken an enormous amount of my time. And I think it's detracted from the amount of time that I might have spent out in parishes. And if I had it to do over again, or if I didn't have those type of challenges, I would have been more pastorally present to people.
You've been great about serving those people who others don't want to serve. We're talking about Hope House, and we're talking about some of the other things that you've done. This is a country now which doesn't have much respect for people who have very little. And the more we see, the more it happens. So you were sort of pushing against the tide when you helped, you know, people who were suffering from alcoholism or depression or those things. I mean, that's what really has made you a great bishop, is in my opinion. It has to be tough to run against the tide.
Well, it is tough to run against the tide, but it was never a difficult decision for me to make. Because as Matthew 25 says, as often you do it to the least of my brothers or sisters, you've done it unto me. And I've always felt that that should be the direction, the guidance, the vision that I should follow. So I was delighted to have wonderful opportunities to serve the Urban League, to be the first president of Living Resources Corporation, which was an organization to help the development of disabled. And I'll tell you, some of the worst meetings I ever attended were to try to site a group home for developmental disabled back in the 70s when it was new, because we didn't have any place else to point to rebut the arguments that the property values would go down, that they would be a danger to people in the community and so forth. Now we can cite 50, 60, 70 places and say, go and look and ask the neighbors next door what it was like. But back in the 70s, that was a tough road to hoe. And then with Hope House, when I went to the powers that be.
Can you just tell us what Hope House was?
Yes, Hope House is a drug treatment program. When I first started working in the South End of Albany, the number one problem that I encountered was heroin addiction. And when I looked around to find out what was available to respond to people who were so addicted, I found not only that there was no treatment program in Albany, but none in the entire northeastern part of New York State. And when I sought to get resources to begin a program, I was told point blank that heroin abuse was a New York City problem, not an upstate problem. And so initially, I had to, first of all, get people into the Albany Medical Center, get them detoxed, then physically drive them down to the Catskills, to a place like Daytop Village or Renison House, to get them rehabilitated. And finally, they said, hey, we're being funded by New York City resources, and we can't continue to take people from upstate New York. So you got to start your own place. And that's how Hope House really got off the ground. Now we got three residential treatment programs, an outpatient program, a program for community integration. And I think we lived up to our motto, where there's life, there's hope.
Can you rehabilitate drug addicts?
Oh, we've had a wonderful track record. I'm not saying that we're always successful. There is always a possibility of recidivism, and sometimes recidivism two or three times before a person actually is able to integrate everything and live a sober life. But we have example after example of people who are successfully rehabilitated. And one of the great joys of my life is to be walking down the street or into a shopping center or something and have somebody come up to me and say, Bishop, you probably don't remember me, but I was at Hope House in 1982 and 1986, and you saved my life, or you with the people at Hope House saved my life. I mean, it wasn't me personally, but it was the staff at Hope House that saved their lives. And I have that happen many times during the course of a year, and that always gives me such a great sense of pride and satisfaction that I had some role in playing in that person's rehabilitation.
Talk to me about aging. You and I are both older now than we were when we started out in this stuff. How do you look at aging?
Well, I look upon it as just another life transition, you know, and I've always been surprised by what's happened to me in life. I never got an assignment that I wanted. I always wanted to be a parish priest. I was sent back to Catholic University to study social work to go into Catholic Charities, which I didn't want to do. I thought I was going to be an ecclesiastical bureaucrat for the next 30 years. And then I got pulled out to start Providence House and Hope House, which I never would have outlined for myself. And then I was elected by the priest of the diocese to be head of the priest personnel board and to do pastoral planning, which I never would have chosen for myself. And I think that's the reason that I was selected as bishop, which I never would have imagined for myself. And so I've always been surprised by how life transitions take place, and always was something I didn't plan. And so as I look toward retirement, although I'm still going to be active, I'll still be a priest, what it will unfold will be something that I'm sure is going to be good, because everything else in my life has been good. And so I'm just depending upon God's providence in that.
There's so many roads you've just opened up, but I want to ask you quickly, when you just said you're still going to be a priest, will you serve in a parish?
Well, I will live in a parish. I don't know which one yet, but I will live in a parish once I'm able to figure out when I'm going to actually retire. And I will be available either in that parish or in other parishes throughout the diocese to help out on weekends. Every weekend we have a list of parishes that need somebody to help out because the priest is sick or on vacation or retreat or something like that. So there's no loss of opportunity that is going to be present once I'm retired. I'll have plenty of opportunities to serve as a priest, and I'd like to think about maybe working in the jails or nursing homes as well. So I'm looking forward to
doing what you always wanted to do.
Always what I wanted to do and was prevented from doing for a variety of reasons.
Okay, here's a tough one. Tell me about your relationship with God. What do you see God as, or who do you see God as?
I see God as a God of love. I think the nature of God is love beyond measure. I tell the youngsters at confirmation, and I do 40 or 50 confirmations each year, that God loves them totally, completely, and unconditionally. There are voices out there that will tell you that you're filled with sin and failure, that you're a loser, that you don't really matter in God's sight. But I say there's nothing further from the truth. Our God is a God of love. Our God is a God of mercy and forgiveness. And there is nothing that we can do that can ever separate us from the love of God. That's my perspective on God.
But God, does God have a face to you?
I think God does have a face. I don't know what that face looks like. I don't fully understand our teaching that God is three in one, three persons in one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I don't believe I'll understand that until I stand before the throne of God in heaven, but I believe it. And I believe that God not only has one face, but has three faces, and they're all integrated into one. And there's a unity there that I don't fully grasp, but that I try to emulate and will look forward to understanding fully once I pass from this life to the next.
There are many people who don't believe there's a next, but you say there is.
I really believe that with my heart and soul. I could not live the way I live if I didn't believe there was a life hereafter. I understand that people don't believe in God, and I appreciate their perspective, and I'm sure they're following their conscience and their lights. But as Pope Francis said just recently, he believes that even those who don't believe in God can be saved as long as they're following their conscience and doing what they believe to be right. And I believe the same thing.
There are many people in the church and in my religion, the Jewish religion, who don't believe that, who believe if you mess up, if you don't follow the rules, you're in trouble.
Well, certainly you expect that the rules be followed, and I don't know how God will judge each and every person.
Sure.
I leave that to God. That's beyond my pay grade. But I do believe that if a person has lived the best life they possibly can and have lived it according to their conscience, then God will embrace them wholeheartedly.
Okay. I'm sorry for butting in, but what about all those people you served pastorally who you took care of and drove to addiction services and the rest of those, and you just said lived the best that they could? Do those people have a chance of getting to heaven?
Oh, absolutely. Jesus in his ministry reached out to those who were ostracized in his time. and treated them entirely different than the other religious leaders at the time did. You take the woman who was caught in a very act of adultery, and they were about to stone her, and Jesus began writing in the sand, and everybody moved away. And then Jesus said to the adulteress, and there's no question about the fact she was an adulteress, "Woman, has no one else condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And he said, "Neither will I condemn you."
Hmm.
And that's my image of God.
Yeah, yeah. So when you hear other clergy saying hellfires and brimstone, you say?
Well, I think that God has a plan of life that he's outlined for us in both the Hebrew Scriptures and the New Testament and in other religious texts. And I think that you have a responsibility to try to live up to those teachings and those ideals. But if you fall short, or if because of addiction or depression or because of family dysfunction, you do not measure up, but you do the best you can within that framework, I think God will embrace you wholeheartedly.
And that leads me to the next question, which Mario Cuomo once asked me. Do you think there is a hell?
I think there is a hell. How long it lasts, what it consists of, I don't know. I'll leave that to God.
So you have all these children in your parish, all these kids who go to schools, all these kids. You have a wonderful face of Catholicism that not everybody has, let's face it. And, you know, you've offered a lot of people some major hope. You said that the guy walks up to you in the shopping center who had addiction services and says, "You've saved you, the church, or you, Bishop, have saved my life." Do those kids come away with something based on what you've taught them?
Oh, they certainly do, because if they are truly rehabilitated and are not living a life of drugs, they become wonderful parents. They draw upon their own hardships, which makes them much more understanding and empathetic toward others. They become wonderful people in their own areas of occupation or profession, and they have a lot to offer, more than many who have not gone through the type of suffering that they have had. So I think there is redemption, and I think after redemption comes an even fuller life.
You told a newspaper that you try to be a compassionate shepherd. We only got a couple seconds left, a couple of minutes left. What does that mean?
Well, it means that I really want to accept people where they are, that I want to tell them of God's love, to tell them to follow God's plan of life is not limiting or is not in any way going to drag you down or to make life harder or more unpleasant for you, but it's really by following the commandments, by following the Beatitudes, that you really find happiness. Because what the commandments and the Beatitudes do is tell you to love yourself and to love others as yourself. And if you do truly love yourself and try to live your life to the fullest, and if you reach out in service to other people, especially those who are poor and forgotten and marginalized, then you are giving life 100-fold. And in that giving, you'll find happiness. As St. Francis said, it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoning, and it is in dying that we're born to eternal life. And that's how I think we must live.
So when you say love yourself, that's almost universal in terms of what religions teach and others teach. And when you see some of the hatred that comes out just because, you know, the Muslims and the Jews and factions within them, which go and take lives because people have a different orientation, what does that do to you?
It saddens me greatly. It's tolerance, respect, appreciation for the dignity of the other must always be a primary focus that we have. And when we engage in violence and terrorism, when we engage in stereotyping and tearing down, we're going against exactly what God has asked us to do.
We've been talking with Bishop Howard Hubbard of the Albany Diocese. Bishop Hubbard, my friend and a person I so much admire, thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you, Alan, and my best wishes to you and to all of your listeners.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.